My Lord, my God, I firmly believe that you are here. That you see me, that you hear me, that you love me. I adore you with profound reverence. I ask your forgiveness for my sins and for the grace to make this time of prayer fruitful. My Immaculate Mother, Saint Joseph, my guardian angel, intercede for me. Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. The fundamental reform of the Church, according to Pope Francis, is to allow the Lord once again to shape us into an evangelizing Church. The Church doesn't just have a mission, but is a mission. We'll have a chance to talk about this much more tomorrow. But Pope Francis, in his apostolic exhortation, says that likewise, none of us has a mission, but each of us is a mission. He wrote in Evangelii Gaudium, The Joy of the Gospel, I am a mission. And that mission involves going to preach the gospel to the peripheries, not just in terms of geography, north and south, east and west, but those who are on the margins of existence, those who are in the outskirts, those who have been forgotten, and they can be right next to us in the heart of a city. It means preaching the gospel to the poor, to the unwanted, to the discarded, to the abandoned. It means not inviting those who can repay us to dinner, but the poor, crippled, lame, and blind who can't. Now, I think it was highly significant December 17th when Pope Francis celebrated his birthday. Do you know how he celebrated his birthday? He invited four homeless guys over with their dog to come to Mass and then to share breakfast with him. He could have invited world leaders, but instead he invited four homeless people with their dog. Straight out of the gospel. A lot of people, when they heard that story, just say, ooh, 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 Pope Francis. What a guy that he would actually do this. It's straight out of the gospel. We should all be doing it. The fundamental corruption of the Church, Pope Francis has been saying since before his election, is when the Church gets so focused on herself, on those who are already coming, on those who are already contributing, on those who can scratch our back in return, that we really forget about the forgotten. We care for the sheep in the fold, but don't care adequately for all those people who are really suffering. In all of this is in everything. Pope Francis wants to show us the gospel, not just teach us with words. He himself has been going to the peripheries. He's gone to refugee centers where those who are treated and even called aliens, as if they were from another planet, are often subjected to terrible conditions. He's gone to jail to care for incarcerated teens in which most of society has no hope for reform. He's gone to children's hospital to care for those who are suffering enormously. He's gone to poor villages and even poor homes to bring hope to the poor, sharing their simple meals, having a cup of cachaça with his espresso in the morning. Cachaça is Brazilian moonshine. He's identified with the poor, living very simply both before and after his papal election, taking simple transportation, identifying very much with the poor he's striving to serve. Changed the papal almoner's office, the almsgiving office, the eleemosynary is what it's called. Whereas in the past, the papal almoner's office was the one who, for the Pope, would sign all the papal blessings. And they'd take the money for the parchment there and they'd give it over to the poor. Pope Francis turned to one of his master of ceremonies who had a reputation, Don Conrad, a Polish priest, going out in the middle of the night to care for the poor. So he turned to him and said, I'm going to make you the Archbishop Papal Almoner. The first thing I want you to do is sell your desk and give it to the poor because you're not going to need your desk. He wanted him to really go out and find the poor. That's what the charity office of the Pope needs to do, and that's what he insisted would be done, to go out and actively find the poor and help them in concrete ways. And he has. Pope Francis has gone out into the crowd not in search of royalty or celebrities, but those who the world not only considers nobodies but burdens. He's embraced handicapped kids and adults. He's allowed a Down's syndrome teen to ride in the Popemobile with him. In one of the most iconic scenes of his papacy that I've printed and, you know, and blown up as a photograph and framed in my office because it's really a perpetual challenge for me, he embraced even those whom charitable people would have found physically revolting. In the beginning of November, you probably saw photographs of Vinicio Rivas, who had these neurofibromatotic tumors growing all over his face, 53 years old. There were two types of what he had. One's contagious, one's not. Turned out by coincidence that Vinicio had the non-contagious type, but the Pope didn't realize that. Vinicio has suffered so much in his Catholic faith. When he goes with all those tumors to church, nobody wants to sit anywhere close to him. He goes on a bus, everybody starts moving. Parents protect their kids from him. He's treated like a pariah because of something that's obviously outside of his control. But his sister, was going to be traveling down with a pilgrimage from her town of Vicenza in the north of Italy to meet the Pope. She asked him if he'd like to come, and he said, why not? So he went. He was in a wheelchair because he's got these tumors on the bottom of his feet, and it makes him very hard for him to stand and to walk. So as he was being rolled in the wheelchair, he was supposed to stay with the entire group from Vicenza. But all the gendarmeria, the Vatican police, as well as the Swiss guards, whenever they see somebody in a wheelchair, they go all the way up to the front. And so he didn't know that, neither did his aunt. And they just kept being brought up closer and closer and closer, right there to the front row. And at the end of the audience, Pope came down, as he always does, to greet those who are in the wheelchairs. First person he went over to was this Vinicio. And he just saw his face, and you've probably seen the photos. Starts putting his hands on the back of Vinicio's head and just tugs his head and puts it right next to his heart for over a minute. Here's what Vinicio said. He didn't have any fear of my illness. I'm not contagious, but there's no way he would have known that. He just did it. Period. He caressed my whole face, and while he was doing it, I felt only love. It lasted longer than a minute, but it felt like it was an eternity. I quivered. I felt great warmth. And he said that that just encounter brought a great change in him. I felt stronger and happier. I feel I can move ahead because the Lord is protecting me. You know, just like his namesake, Pope Francis, St. Francis, who, when he was a soldier prior to his main conversion, but was one of the triggers of his conversion, was riding on his horse towards Spoleto. And a man came out of the bushes, a leper, asking for an alms. Francis dropped the alms into his hand. He didn't want to even get close to touching the man's flesh. The man himself was grateful for the charity that Giovanni Bernardone had given him before he was called Frenchy. That's where we get Francesco. It wasn't his baptismal name. It was because his mom was French. But as Francis started to gallop off, his heart was touched, and he said, that's just not right. So he dismounted, he went back, he hugged the leper, and he kissed his hands. That was the real beginning of Francis's major conversion, when he started to be touched by the suffering of another, such that it would bring out from within him real love. And that's been Pope Francis's adult life, doing this type of stuff for people that even good priests would regularly ignore. When he hasn't been able to get out himself, he has used his cell phone still to reach. He said last week in an interview with La Stampa that there's a widow, 81 years old, who lost her son, and Francis calls her once a month just to console her. Could be any old woman. We don't know her nationality. But that Francis puts an appointment on his calendar to make sure that he's calling this Catholic woman to console her for her having buried her son. We know that he called Carlo Samaria, an 80-year-old cobbler in Buenos Aires, to inquire about his shoe repair, and then to let him know right after his election that he wouldn't be retrieving his footgear, that somebody else would be coming for it. Telephoned his newspaper man, Daniel Del Reno, to cancel his subscription, to thank him for delivering the newspaper to him faithfully for so many years. He famously tried to call the Superior General of the Jesuits, Father Nicholas, but the young Jesuit at the switchboard didn't believe he was the Pope. So when he said, "Sono Papa," the young Jesuit said, "Et io sono Napoleano." And I'm Napoleon. It's becoming clear, however, that Pope Francis has found another type of use for his phone. He's using it as a bridge to reach out to those in need on the fringes. On August 7th, he called Michele Ferri, who had written him for prayers because he was finding it impossible to forgive the two men who had murdered his younger brother, Andrea, in Pesaro, Italy. Pope Francis called him, told him that he cried reading his letter, comforted him about the death of his brother, encouraged him to forgive, and then asked to speak to his mother, to extend to her his deepest sympathies as well. On August 18th, he phoned Stefano Cabizza, a 19-year-old computer engineer from Padua, worried about finding a job after graduation. Young Stefano had gone to Castel Gandolfo August 15th, a papal summer residence. It was one time that Pope Francis went over there because normally the Pope, who stays at Castel Gandolfo during the summer, celebrates the Solemnity of the Assumption in the small little church there in the main square of Castel Gandolfo. So he wanted to go celebrate the Mass and thank all the people out in Castel Gandolfo for their hospitality to everybody who comes there, Christ's name. And as he was heading out, this young student wanted to pass him a note but couldn't get to him. So he just found a cardinal and said, "Could you please give this to the Pope?" So the cardinal gives it to the Swiss guard who's there at the residence, and it gets to the Pope. And the Pope calls Stefano's home. Stefano wasn't there. No, he's not here. "Who's this?" "Well, I prefer not to say. Do you know when he'll be home?" "Yeah, he'll be home about 5 o'clock. "Okay, I'll call then." Calls back at 5 o'clock. "Is Stefano there?" No, is this the person who called before?" "Yeah, he's not home yet." "Well, when's he going to be home?" "It was sometime tonight." Just like, "Well, listen, can you reach him and say that I'll be calling back at 8 o'clock tonight? And it's just an important phone call." "Okay." So calls back at 8 o'clock, third time. "Show something." And Stefano is blown away that it was the Pope calling in response to his letter. An 8-minute conversation filled with laughter, Pope Francis filled Stefano with hope. And he did something really interesting. Stefano was, sua santità. He was calling him, your holiness and all the stuff with the elevated Italian form of language. And Pope Francis said, "Stefano, use tu with me. Use the informal form, the form among friends." And Stefano was just like, "You're the Holy Father. How could I ever use the tu with you?" And Pope Francis said, according to Stefano's interview, "Stefano, you don't really think Jesus had the apostles call him Your Excellency, do you?" On August 25th, he phoned Alejandra Pereira, a 44-year-old Argentinian mother of 6, who had written him describing that she had been raped by a Buenos Aires police officer at gunpoint in his cruiser, but that the police department was covering up the rape and actually promoted the officer in question. Pope Francis spent a half hour with her, patiently listening to her story. He encouraged her to be calm and reminded her that she was not alone. She said in an interview that the encounter gave her back her faith, her confidence, and her courage to continue seeking justice. On November 1st, he called a fierce critic who had written public articles criticizing the Holy Father's liturgical practices, and by the name of Mario Palmaro. And there were some who support the extraordinary form of the Mass who have been incredibly critical of Pope Francis. I don't know why. He hasn't stopped anything, but part of it is because of the Franciscan Friars of the Immaculate over there and the needed reform that's happening to that order. Regardless, this guy with a real cause to criticism had lacerated Pope Francis with his words. But Pope Francis found out that he was suffering from stage 4 cancer. So he got his number and he called him. Palmaro said in an interview, "I was astonished. I was amazed, above all, moved. For me, a Catholic, what I was experiencing was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life." When he tried to clarify that he didn't really mean what he had written publicly in a paper, the Pope cut him off. Mario said that he didn't let me finish my sentence. He said that he understood that the criticisms of I had made had been made with love for the Church and how important it was for him to have received them. Perhaps the most moving of all happened September 3rd. Pope Francis called Anna Romano, a 35-year-old woman living in Rome, whose boyfriend, after she told him she was pregnant, divulged he had lied to her the entire time and he was married, and tried to persuade her to have an abortion. So she wrote in anguish to the Pope asking for his prayers. She never expected a phone call. But he called, spoke to her as a friend, mentioned how strong and brave she was, and as she told an Italian newspaper, reassured me, telling me that the baby growing within me was a gift from God, a sign of providence. He told me that I would not be left alone. And after she expressed her worry that because she's a divorcee, her baby might not be able to be baptized, Pope Francis told her he was sure she would be able to find a willing pastor. But if not, you always have me. He's not, in doing any of this, a conventional liberal or conservative, to use the political categories that never really fit anybody in the Church. He's not pushing for governments to find a solution to everything. He's rather telling us to give others something to eat, just like Jesus did. And he's also not saying that all of this has to happen by private charity, saying rather it's a thing of justice and that individual handouts are never going to suffice. That there's a need for systemic solutions at the same time. To many, especially in the affluent areas of the West, while his example is inspiring, his words are also really challenging. He's seeking to get us to love our neighbor in real deeds, rather than just talk about loving our neighbor. What I'd like to do in this conference is tackle how he's seeking to reform the Church as a whole and each of us to make our love for neighbor more practical. Pope Francis is convinced that this is essential for the reform of the Church and for the fulfillment of the mission that is the Church. Pope Francis has stressed that structural reform of the Church comes after a change in attitude to make the whole Church a good Samaritan rather than a bunch of bureaucrats. In that interview in September, he said, "How are we treating God's people? I dream of a church that's a mother and a shepherdess. Church's ministers must be merciful, and we're all servants of the Lord. We're all ministers in a sense. Church's ministers must be merciful, take responsibility for the people and accompany them like the Good Samaritan who washes, cleanses, and raises up his neighbor. This is pure gospel. God's greater than sin. The structural and organizational reforms are secondary. That is, they come afterward. The first reform must be the attitude. The ministers of the gospel must be people who can warm the hearts of people, who walk through the dark night with them, who know how to dialogue and to descend themselves into the people's night, into the darkness, but without getting lost. People want pastors, not clergy acting like bureaucrats or government officials. People want Christians to act on the Lord's words rather than to just be able to quote them. His inaugural Mass, he stressed that authentic power in the church always is service. This is what we should all be ambitious for. He said, certainly Jesus Christ conferred power upon Peter, but what sort of power was it? Talking about his own idea of the papacy here. Jesus' three questions to Peter, Peter, do you love me more than these? Are followed by three commands. Feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. Pope Francis said, let us never forget that authentic power is service, and that the Pope too, when exercising power, must enter ever more fully into that service which has its radiant culmination on the cross. He must give all. He must be inspired by the lowly, concrete, and faithful service that marked St. Joseph. And like him, he was preaching this on the feast day of St. Joseph. And he must open his arms to protect all of God's people and embrace with tender affection the whole of humanity, especially the poorest, the weakest, the least important, those whom Matthew lists in his final judgment on love, the hungry, the thirsty, the stranger, the naked, the sick, and those in prison. Only those who serve with love are able to protect. You know, there's a little allusion there to Jesus' dialogue with St. Peter at the end of the Gospel. After Peter had betrayed the Lord gave him three chances to repent and do restitution. He made really clear to Peter what he was asking of him. But it's also a dialogue he wants to have happen with us. When he says, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And Simon says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus didn't say, cool, Peter, awesome. We love each other. That's all that I wanted. He said, feed my sheep, tend my lambs, feed my lambs. Likewise, Jesus, during the Last Supper, didn't say, love me the way I love you. He said, love one another the way I love you. And the real test of whether we love the Lord is when we love others. Dorothy Day, whose cause for canonization is before the Vatican. Dorothy Day had a saying that's always haunted me because it's so true and it's a perpetual call to conversion. She said, we love the Lord Jesus to the extent that we love the person we like the least. Think about that person right now whom you like the least. We all have those people in our life. We love the Lord to the extent that we love that person. Now again, after the homily on loving your enemies, we know that there are four verbs for love. We're not saying that we have to have affection for the person we like the least. We're not saying that we have to be best friends. We're not saying that we're going to get married to a person we can't stand. We are saying invincible goodwill toward this person. That we really want the absolute best. We want God, and we're willing to sacrifice. We're willing even to die for that person, if that's what it takes. That's the way we love the Lord. I want to tell a little bit of a story about the way Benedictines welcome people, because it's always very much moved me, at least in the rule of St. Benedict. Not every Benedictine monastery has lived this way, but it really illustrates a very important point. I read the rule of St. Benedict every year on his feast day, July 11th. I'm almost always preaching retreat for women religious during those days, and I have more time to pray, and so that's a great way to do it. It only takes a good half hour. But here's the way hospitality is supposed to happen in the Benedictine monastery. When the guest knocks at the door and it's recognized as a guest who's seeking shelter for the night, the porter's supposed to ring the bell so that everybody in the monastery except someone who absolutely can't leave what he's doing at that time must leave and come to the welcoming area. And then when they're there, they all lie prostrate before the guest. And then the abbot, the head honcho, And if he's not there, the prior, number two. If he's not there, which will almost never happen, whoever they've delegated the leadership of the monastery, then takes this guest into the chapel to pray. And then the abbot asks if the person's hungry. Even though a lot of Benedictines only have booze 3 or 4 times a year. And you know, the steward of the wine cellar has a key. The abbot always gets the one with the wine cellar to go and see if he needs any wine. Something that they'll only have a few times during the year. And then the abbot shows him to his room, sees if he has everything that he needs. Now, if you had one guest a month, you could say, boy, that's beautiful. If you had one guest a day, you could say, it's mortification. We'll all do it. If you're getting several guests a day, and you're all interrupting whatever you're doing and lying prostrate, and the abbot who's got to run the whole monastery is basically spending all of this time with this vagrant who's just showed up, it would become quite onerous. But the reason why they do that is because Saint Benedict wrote very clearly in his rule, Hospes Christus est. The guest is Christ. We need to treat every guest, every stranger, as if it's Jesus saying, I was a stranger and you welcome me. And if we knew it was Jesus who was that fourth guest on a given Tuesday, wouldn't we want everybody in the monastery to come? Wouldn't we pay homage to him? Wouldn't it be worth the abbot's time to take him into the chapel? Wouldn't it be worth the abbot's time to spend with him as he eats, even to get him some wine, as much as he'd like? Wouldn't it be worth the abbot's time to take him to his room? Would be. They love the Lord to the extent that they love each guest who comes. Jesus makes it very simple, which doesn't mean easy, but conceptually it is very simple. We treat others the way we would treat Jesus. When they are hungry, he's hungry. When they are thirsty, he's thirsty. When they are imprisoned, he's imprisoned. This is a service that all of us must seek to give. But for those of us who take our faith more seriously, for whom more has been given, and therefore more is to be expected, we're even more summoned to this service by the Lord and should seek to do it with all our heart. Last Holy Thursday, he did something very beautiful. I wish that he had gone earlier in the day so that there would have been no confusion. But he went to a juvenile prison, the Casal di Marmo in Rome, where he celebrated Holy Thursday and he washed the inmates' feet, including some Muslims, including some women. He gave a little bit of a homily there, which explains the way he looks not only at his papacy, but also his discipleship. He said in that brief little homily, Jesus himself explains to his disciples, do you know what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that's who I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've sent you an example that you should do just as I have done for you. Pope Francis comments, it's the Lord's example. He's the most important of all, and he washes feet, because with us what is highest must be at the service of others. This is a symbol, a sign, right? Washing feet means I am at your service. And with us too, don't we have to wash each other's feet every day? What does this mean? It means we have to help one another. Help one another. This is what Jesus teaches us, and this is what I'm doing, and doing with all my heart, because it's my duty. As a priest and a bishop, I must be at your service. But it is a duty that comes from my heart. I love it. I love this. And I love to do it because that's what the Lord has taught me to do. Now we will perform the ceremony of washing feet, and let us think, let each one of us think, Am I really willing to serve, to help, to love others? Let us think about this. Let us think that this is a sign of the caress of Jesus, that Jesus gives us, because this is the real reason why Jesus came, to serve, to help us. You know, if you remember that gesture of the washing of the feet, it was a task that only a slave did. If you were rich, you had sandals. If you weren't rich, you really didn't have any footwear. And all the animals would go to the bathroom all over the dirt roads. So it was washing feet was basically like cleaning toilets in the ancient world. And Jesus, Lord Master, got and washed the toilets of the 12 apostles. And then he said, that's what I want you to do. I want you to go to clean all the cesspools of the world. Nothing's going to be beneath you. Because you're not doing just an action. You're doing something out of love for a person who needs to be cared for. Once you start there, there's nothing that you won't hesitate to do for the sake of love. This type of service comes from a new type of hearing, Pope Francis said. When we're truly listening to the Lord's voice, then with Him, we will hear the cry of the poor. We will hear the cry of our brothers and sisters in need. We'll learn how to cry with them. If Pope Francis lives to 100, the greatest homily he will have ever preached, he gave last July 8th. A tiny little island called Lampedusa, to the south of Sicily. Lampedusa, almost no Americans had ever heard of before he had gone there. But Lampedusa is the Ellis Island of Europe. For all the Africans trying to escape from bloodshed in their countries, all the Christians, frankly, trying to escape from Muslim persecution, especially the Eritreans and the Ethiopians, who are being massacred by the Muslims, including when they're going to church. They hop on these boats that are fit for about 20 people, on which they pack 150. They have to pay the equivalent in US dollars, $40,000. Think about that as an African. 40 grand to get on one of these boats. So precious is escaping from what's suffering. They sell everything in order to try to get on that boat. It's only a 70-mile journey, but it takes many hours. And over the course of the last 20 years, 25,000 people have perished. 25,000! Now, it's about the same distance from the tip of Cuba to Miami. And every time somebody has died there, we've heard about it. But the deaths there have been by the hundreds. Still, 100 way too many. But Lampedusa, 25,000 in the last 20 years. And nobody had heard about Lampedusa. And a couple weeks before the Pope went, there was another boat that crashed against the big rock walls that are on the southern side of the island. And the boat was continually being pushed up against the rocks. And there were people who, when the boat had capsized, who were over there in the water, including a pregnant woman who was trying to survive until the boat crushed her to death. Pope Francis, in his first trip outside of Rome, wanted to shine the spotlight of the world on Lampedusa. And he gave his greatest homily ever, which I'm going to quote at length, because it wasn't just for the people in that little island that he was preaching. It was for all of us. Two questions echo today from the book of Genesis, Pope Francis said, and they echo as forcefully as ever. How many of us, myself included, have lost our bearings? We are no longer attentive to the world in which we live. We don't care. We don't protect what God has created for everyone. And we end up unable to care for one another. And when humanity as a whole loses its bearings, it results in tragedies like the one we have witnessed here. First question. Where is your brother, Cain? Where's your brother? His blood cries out to me, says the Lord. Pope Francis says, this is not a question directed toward others. It's a question directed to me, to you, to each of us. These brothers and sisters of ours were trying to escape difficult situations to find some serenity and peace. They were looking for a better place for themselves and for their family. But instead, they found death. How often do such people fail to find understanding? Fail to find acceptance, fail to find solidarity. And their cry rises up to God. He then thanked the people of Lampedusa for their solidarity. And he said that, I listened to one of these brothers of ours. Before arriving here to celebrate the Mass, he and others were at the mercy of traffickers, people who exploit the poverty of others, people who live off of others' misery. How much these people have suffered, and so many never even made it here. Where is your brother? Who's responsible for his blood? Then you remember that he was a high school literary teacher, lit teacher in Argentina. So he gave one of the stories that was often used in his classes. He said, in Spanish literature, we have a comedy of Lope de Vega that tells how the people of the town Fuente Ovejuna, basically the place where the sheep would go and water, that's what it means in Spanish. Fuente Ovejuna, how the people of the town of Fuente Ovejuna kill their governor because he's a tyrant. They do it in such a way that no one of them knows who actually killed the man. And so when the royal judge comes to investigate, he asks, ¿Quién mató el gobernador? Who killed the governor? They all reply, Fuente Ovejuna, Señor. The town killed him. Everybody and nobody. Today, too, the question has to be asked, who's responsible for the blood of these brothers and sisters? Nobody! That's our answer. It ain't me. I don't have anything to do with it. Somebody else's responsibility, certainly not mine. Yet God is asking each of us, where is the blood of your brother that is crying out to me? Today, no one in our world feels responsible. We've lost a sense of responsibility for our brothers and sisters. We've fallen into the hypocrisy of the priest and the Levite whom Jesus described in the parable of the Good Samaritan. We see our brother half dead on the side of the road. And perhaps we say to ourselves, poor fella. But then we go on our way. It's not our responsibility, we say to ourselves. And we feel somehow assured and assuaged. The culture of comfort, which makes us think only of ourselves, makes us insensitive to the cries of other people, makes us live in soap bubbles that, however lovely, are insubstantial. It's a soap bath in which we're just sort of pouring on the suds without really focusing on the real world. We say, Calgon, get me out of here. Makes us insensitive to the cries of others. It offers us a fleeting and empty illusion that results in indifference to others. Indeed, it leads to the globalization of indifference. In our globalized world, we've fallen into a globalized indifference. We've become used to the suffering of others. It doesn't affect us. It doesn't concern us. We think it's none of our business. Second question. Adam, where are you? This question, along with the question, where is your brother, are questions that God asks at the dawn of human history, in which He also asks each man and each woman in our own day. He also asks it of us. But I'd like to ask a third question. Has any one of us wept because of this situation and others like it? Has any one of us grieved for the death of these brothers and sisters? Has any one of us wept for these persons who were on the boat who never made it? For the young mothers carrying their babies? For these men who were looking for means of supporting their families? We're a society who has forgotten how to weep.
how to experience compassion, literally how to suffer with others. The globalization of indifference has taken away from us the ability to weep.
In the gospel, we've heard the crying, the wailing, the great lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children because they are no more. Herod so deaf to protect his own comfort, his own soap bubble. And so it continues. Let us ask the Lord to remove the part of Herod that lurks in our hearts. Let us ask the Lord for the grace to weep over our indifference, to weep over the cruelty of the world, to weep over the cruelty of our own hearts, and of all those who in anonymity make social and economic decisions that open the door to tragic situations like this. Has anyone wept today? Has anyone wept in the world? That was the finish of his homily. Do we weep over the suffering of others? Or do we just go on with our own business, like the priest and the Levite in the parable of the Good Samaritan? We cannot fix all the problems in the world. But are we touched by those problems? And do we try to help those situations that we really can help? We don't have to go to an island off the tip of the bottom of Sicily in order to start living this type of stuff. Same type of thing happens at the Mexican-American border all over the place. It happens in cities and towns all across the United States, where we basically say to those who entered our country illegally or have stayed illegally, get out of my country. And it's a plague that's particularly impacted Catholics. Whenever I go around, whenever questions come up like this, there are always questions about the U.S. bishops, about immigration policy, and why don't the bishops just sort of let politics handle that and everything opinable happen? There are lots of things that we can do opinably, whether we're going to prioritize the securing the border before we sort of handle the undocumented, whatever else. Lots of practical issues about which bishops have no expertise. But I think that there's something really deep within. I remember I was given a talk up in Maine a few months ago after a parish mission. And in one of the question and answer nights, everybody came and this guy brought it. And he was frustrated with the whole thing. So he gives all his own reasons. And for the most part, he had the right footnotes. And I just asked him, sir, can I ask you one question? Sure, Father. I said, would you ever say what you just said about your blood brother or sister? That if your blood brother and sister were here, having risked their life to come to the United States, that you want them deported. Would you ever say that about your brother or sister, or anybody that you really loved? He paused and he said, what's the point of that question? I said, it's the point of the question. When we recognize that most of these immigrants you're talking about deporting are actually our Christian brothers and sisters, not just sons of the same Creator, but actually spiritual siblings, closer to us by baptism than I am to my identical twin brother by genes. Would you ever say that to anybody you cared about, that you want them out of the country until they've got the right paperwork? Would you ever do that? And he didn't answer. I said, a fortiori, would you ever say that to Jesus? Get out of my country, Jesus, because you don't have the right color card? Would you ever say that? He said, Father, I didn't want to pick a fight. I said, actually, I'm identifying because those are my brothers and sisters. And just like if you were to attack my mom, I'm not going to let you get away with it. You're attacking my sister, you're attacking my brother. It's Jesus in disguise. Jesus said, when I was a stranger, you welcomed me. Or when I was a stranger, you gave me no welcome. That's what's going to determine whether we go to the right or the left. Now, there are a lot of practical issues that we need to work on out in which we can have different opinions. But one thing we can't have a different opinion about is the way we're supposed to love that brother and sister, regardless of their status. And whatever we do to them, we've got to recognize we're doing to Jesus, we're doing to our brother and sister. So get that right. There's an indifference about these people who'd pay $20,000 for one of these coyotes to take them over the border, risking their life being shot at in these ranches by people who just think
that basically illegal immigrants should be treated like demons or cockroaches coming into a house, where you just kind of get rid of them as if there's no personality there. Globalized indifference. You know, Jesus says at the end of Matthew 25, "When I was hungry, you fed me." But there are many who, when Jesus appears hungry and thirsty, say, "Get a job, you lazy louch." Jesus says, "When I was naked, you clothed me." And the biggest internet business is to look at porn victims, to look at those caught in pornography. And basically, rather than clothing the naked, we say, "Take it all off." People are in prison. Even Christians stand outside with placards saying, "Take the person's life. Doesn't deserve to live." Rather than seeing Jesus in that prisoner. People are ill. We say, "Too bad you don't have health care." Rather than try to reach out and care for them. Pope Francis is calling us to a much greater sensitivity. Because Jesus called us to that sensitivity. We're not going to be able to solve everything, but first we've got to weep. Then we've got to do what we can. God's world, he said in September, is a world in which we take responsibility for others. We don't say somebody else's problem. We say, "What can I do?" He said, God's world is a world in which everyone feels responsible for the other, for the good of the other. That's God's kingdom. We should ask ourselves tonight, is this really the world I desire? Is it really the world that I carry in my heart? Is that the world I'm living in? Or is the world I'm living in one in which man thinks only of himself, of his own interests, and places himself in the center? When he permits himself to be captivated by the idols of dominion and power, when he puts himself in God's place, and then all relationships are broken and everything's ruined. This is what the book of Genesis teaches us precisely in the story of the fall. It's exactly in this chaos that God asks man's conscience, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And Cain responds, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? He's not my problem." We too are asked this question. And it would be good for us to ask ourselves as well, "Am I really my brother's keeper?" Pope Francis says, "Yes, you are your brother's keeper." To be human means to care for one another. But when harmony is broken, a metamorphosis occurs. The brother who is to be cared for and loved becomes an adversary to fight or to eliminate. When violence occurs at that moment, how many conflicts, how many wars have marked our history? We only need to look at the suffering of so many brothers and sisters. This isn't a question of coincidence, but the truth. We bring about the rebirth of Cain in every act of violence, in every act of war, in every indifference. All of us do. He says our conscience has fallen asleep, and we use the brains God has given us to justify our own indifference. He says we've got to change. That's part of the reform that God's asking the church to lead throughout the world. We must make our neighbor's welfare part of our business, part of our priorities. When he went to the hospital of sick children in when he was in Rio and visited the hospital of sick children called St. Francis of Assisi, he said there, in the Gospel we read the parable of the Good Samaritan that speaks of a man assaulted by robbers and left half dead on the side of the road. People pass him by and look at him. But they don't stop. They just continue on their journey, indifferent to him. None of their business, they say. How often we say to, "Not my problem." How often we turn the other way and pretend as if we didn't see. Only a Samaritan, a stranger, sees him, stops, lifts him up, takes him by the hand, and cares for him. We've heard that parable of the Good Samaritan so many times that we miss what Jesus' listeners would have heard. I'm just going to recite it so that we know what Jesus is really asking. We pass by an alley walking downtown, and we see a man laying there on the ground. Needles all around him. We don't know
quite what's there. But we see him there, and we notice that a missionary of charity is walking down that road, and she looks at him, continues to walk by. Notice a priest walking by. He looks at the same guy and he checks his watch and he says, "I'm going to be late for Mass." And on he goes. And then we see a child molester. Level 3. Comes by. And he sees that man. And he bends down and he starts to care for the man. Finds out that this man had been mugged by drug dealers. Stripped. And he takes him to the Best Western. And he pays for a room where he cares for him all night. And the next morning, gets up and he pays for 2 more full days. Says, "Please look after him. Anything that he charges to room service, I'll pay you back fully on my return." That's what the story is. A despicable man who was the way the Jews looked at a Samaritan was the one who stopped, not the good people. Are we going to be like those people who pass by? Are we going to be the people who has compassion on everyone that's wounded? Jesus calls us to this charity and he promises us that we will be judged by this charity. As you did for one of the least of my brothers and sisters, you did for me. Pope Francis says we have to recover the meaning of Christian charity and fraternal sharing by caring for the bodily and spiritual wounds of our neighbor. And he says once we start to, we have nothing to be afraid of. When we're really loving in this way, we don't have to fear our judgment. Think well about this, he says, that the one who practices mercy has no fear of death. Why do we say this? Because he looks death in the face and the wounds of his brothers and sisters, and he overcomes it with the love of Jesus Christ. If we open the door of our lives and our hearts to our least brothers and sisters, then even our own death will become a door that introduces us to heaven, to the blessed homeland, to which we're directed, longing to dwell forever with God, with Jesus, with Our Lady, and with all the saints. The more we care for those who are needy, the more Jesus will be able to point us regularly to His right side. That's the way we get to His right side. When we give alms, we should always do so respecting others' dignity. It's not for our own ego. It's for their good. And we should do it so that the Father most can see it. You know, St. John Vianney loved to give alms to this blind woman, Mère Bibost, because she could never tell who had walked on up and put the money into her hands. It's a beauty there. Pope Francis, when he would hear confessions, would always ask the question, "Do you give alms?" Most people would say, "Sí, Padre." And then it'd say, "Very good. But when you give alms, do you look the person in the face? Do you make that real human contact?" And then the next question, "When you give alms, do you touch the hand of the person you're giving them to? Or you just drop the coins in a little cup? Do you have that real human love for others?" That's the real charity. I remember one of the toughest experiences of my life when I was up in Toronto. I literally had no money as a seminarian. We had to work in a diocesan job over the summer, and you'd gross $900, and that doesn't pay for gas, and it doesn't pay for insurance, it doesn't pay for anything. The meager savings I had after I finished college were all getting exhausted, such that when I would go to the Canadian pharmacy, I was literally, for the only time in my life, having to figure out if I would get the 62-cent toothpaste or the 59-cent generic toothpaste. It was bad. It's very hard. But one of the times, so I was walking to the pharmacy, this man asked me for some money, and all that I really had was a buck. And I said, I got to go buy something, but I'll give you what I have coming back. It actually cost more, the prices had gone up, and basically I had 11 cents to be able to give this guy. But I sat down with him and I said, "Listen, there is a scene in the gospel in which Peter was asked for an alms at a place called the Beautiful Gate. And he said, "Aurum et argentum non habeo, sed habeo dabo, in nomine Christi Jesu Nazareni, levantate. Silver and gold I have none, but what I do have, I give. In the name of Jesus Christ, get up and walk." I said, "Sir, this is all that I have in terms of money, but I have something far more powerful." I said, "We're actually going to pray here that the Lord's going to send you somebody who can give you what you need to eat." Toronto had let go of all the mental hospitals, so the whole place was mobbed with homeless people. So I prayed with him for a little bit. I said, "Don't be afraid, God will send somebody." I saw him a couple of days later. And he said, he couldn't tell that I was just a seminarian. He said, "Father, I want to tell you what happened the other day." I sat down next to him and I said, "Tell me." He said, "Like 3 minutes after you were gone, this guy came by in this suit and he gave me $50. Can you tell me more about Jesus?" Loving our neighbor ultimately demands giving our life for them. Greater love has no one than to lay down his life for his friends. And Jesus calls us to love others as he has loved us first. We're supposed to give ourselves together with our alms. The church today, he says, must sing a new hymn of service. We're always saying in the Psalms, "Sing a new song to the Lord." But what is this Canticum Novum, this new song? It doesn't consist in words. It's not a melody. It's a song of our life. It's allowing our life to be identified with Jesus, sharing his sentiments, his thoughts, his actions. And the life of Jesus is a life for others. The life of Jesus is a life for others. It's a life of service. Evangelizing means bearing personal witness to the love of God, overcoming our selfishness, bending down to wash the feet of our brethren just like Jesus did. And once we're willing to die for somebody else, really sacrifice, then every other thing that they really need is small. We've got to sing that music. Pope Francis, who can't hold a note, is singing it like a famous tenor. We must join him in that beautiful chorus of charity. The whole church is meant to be a communion of charity. St. Paul said in his first letter to the Corinthians, that very famous passage, that even if he hands his body over to the torturers as a martyr, but doesn't have love, he'll gain nothing. That even if he has the faith to move mountains, but doesn't do it with love, he is nothing. The charity is the real essential. Pope Francis says, "Without love, even the most extraordinary gifts are vain. This man heals people, he has that power, this other virtue, but does he have love and charity in his heart? If he does, then all is well. But if he doesn't, he's no servant of the church. Without love, no gift or charism could serve the church. For where there's not love, there's an emptiness that becomes filled with selfishness. Often we are too dry, too indifferent, too detached, and rather than transmitting brotherhood, we communicate bad temper, coldness, and selfishness." Charity is really just as distinctive a mark of the church as the preaching of the gospel or the celebration of the sacraments. But we've got to plan charity. We just can't let it happen serendipitously. We must respond when somebody comes to us in need, but we have to plan charity. The same way that we prepare for Mass, same way hopefully we have a rhythm when we pray, we've got to plan charity. For a lot of my spiritual directees, consecrated women who live in a house in which there's a need to grow in that practical charity, I said, "Listen, for your almsgiving," they don't have anything to be able to give. What I say, every day I want you to wake up and I want you to say, "I am going to do a concrete act of love for that person." Could be in your house, could be somebody outside. Concrete action could be just a smile, could be sitting next to the person at a meal, could be doing a real favor for the person. But regardless, Some act of charity every day, plan for that person. Even if you do 50 other acts of charity over the course of the day, if you get to the end of the day and you still haven't done an act of charity for that person, at least pray for the person. But plan it. That can start to transform us over the course of time. For not just people who respond when we see needs, but who actually go out looking to help people. Because there are people in ditches everywhere. Pope Francis called religious in particular, but I think it applies to all of us, to wake the whole world up with our charity. That we're supposed to sound an alarm for people, an alarm with our love, and our charity really will wake up the world. I remember when Bishop Sean O'Malley, now Cardinal O'Malley of Boston, became the Bishop of Fall River right after the second of the intense waves of clergy sex abuse in 1992. As soon as he got the letter from the nuncio, where he was a bishop in the Virgin Islands, he called up Blessed Mother Teresa in Calcutta. He said, "Mother, I've just received another assignment from the Holy Father and I need your help." She had known him from Catholic University when he was teaching there. "How can I help you? I need you to send some sisters with me, because the only way we're going to help people recognize the real face of the church is by charity. It's not abuse, it's charity. And I need something conspicuous. Please send your sisters." So she sent him four sisters who remain there to this day in my diocese. But charity is the real face of the church. We must wake up the world with that charity. And for us, the great model of charity, Pope Francis says, is Our Lady, who shows us how to love others with faith. Pope Francis, in October, talked about how ready she was, going with haste to care for her cousin Elizabeth. He said, "In visiting her, the Virgin Mary brought not only material help," she certainly brought that, "but she also brought Jesus, who was already alive in her womb. Bringing Jesus into that house meant bringing joy, the fullness of joy. Elizabeth and Zechariah were rejoicing at the pregnancy that had seemed impossible at their age, but it was the young Mary who brought them the fullness of joy, the joy that comes from Jesus and the Holy Spirit and is expressed by gratuitous charity, by sharing with, helping, and understanding others. Our Lady also wants to bring the great gift of Jesus to us, to us all. And with Him, she brings us His love, His peace, and His joy. In this, the whole church is like Mary. The church isn't a shop. She's not a humanitarian agency, not an NGO. Church is sent to bring Christ and His gospel to all. She doesn't bring herself, whether small or great, strong or weak. Church carries Jesus and should be like Mary when she went to visit Elizabeth. What did Mary take to Elizabeth? She brought Jesus. The church brings Jesus. This is the center of the church, to carry Jesus. If, as an hypothesis, the church were not to bring Jesus, she would be a dead church. The church must bring Jesus, the love of Jesus, the charity of Jesus. That's what we got to bring. And we lead with Jesus by our charity. I finish with a story. It's always moved me very much. Read it a few years ago. Was a journalist traveling in India on the train, stopped at one of the stops, and the journalist saw outside that there was a man selling oranges, and the man was blind. Just kind of took note, wondered if he'd have enough time to just go out and buy a couple oranges just to care for the blind man. But the stops were generally pretty short, and the sort of notice to get on the train was very brief, that he was afraid that he might miss the train if he got off. But he noticed that somebody got off that train who was in a rush carrying two very heavy suitcases and knocked over the man's orange cart. Oranges started rolling downward toward the track. And this blind man, not knowing where he is trying to reach his oranges, can't find any. And he's starting to come closer to the train. So this journalist just says, "I can't witness this." He runs quickly off the train and he pushes the man back and he starts scampering as fast as he can to get those oranges. Then the sound happens on the train saying that you've got more or less the 30-second warning or the minute warning, because it was variable at the other stops. And he thinks for a second And he looks at the blind man, and he just starts running as fast as he can to get all of the oranges to put him back. He just about finishes as the train starts chugging away with his luggage on board, with everything else. And so he says to the blind man, "Sir, all your oranges are here. I'd like to buy a couple if that's okay." "Sure." He said, "Were you the man who helped me collect all those oranges?" "Yes." "But sir, were you just waiting or were you on that train?" He said, "I was on that train." "But you got off. Why?" "Well, I was afraid that you would kill yourself or you'd have an arm or a leg chopped off by the train as it left as you were trying to search for these oranges." He said, "But sir, your bags probably were on that bus or that train." "Yes, that's right." So he just paused for a second and he said, "Is your name Jesus Christ?" We lead by our charity. The blood of so many cries out for us to respond. The same Lord who's inspiring Pope Francis to put the love of God into action will likewise inspire us. We are our brother's keeper. Glory to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.